This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we're talking about free speech, the bedrock of our democracy. Or is it? It seems we're always being told that we're on the precipice of losing it all. The speech, the rights, the freedom. Battlegrounds constantly emerge under a variety of banners. What can we teach our kids in school? What politicians can say to primed crowds? What hell hath our old tweets wrought? But do we even have a firm enough grip on the First Amendment to fight about it? Probably not. Of course, that doesn't mean the arguments over it won't rage fast and furious. In 2019, I sat down with Andrew Marantz, a staff writer at The New Yorker, who'd ventured to ask in an op-ed if free speech, as we've practiced it, was in fact hurting us. It was a question not well received.
I was trying to argue against free speech absolutism. I was trying to say free speech is really important, but we got to worry about what free speech is doing to us in addition to just protecting it.
So, how does it feel to be called a wannabe tyrant, a wannabe Robespierre, and of course, a fascist?
Whenever you write about free speech, obviously the free speech absolutists are going to come out of the woodwork, and there are a lot of absolutists on the internet. But I didn't expect it to be so unrelated to what I actually argued. Arguing not against free speech, which I love and cherish, but arguing against free speech absolutism, that because we value the First Amendment and must protect it, we can't think about or protect or value anything else, including things that might be in opposition to it.
You tweeted to boost your article, as one does. Most of the comments were along the lines of, why don't you move to China? Why don't you move to North Korea? In fact, there was that video of the guy using the Yoda hand puppet.
North Korea. Head there immediately. At 0% gun violence, harassment, and Nazis. They have. Make for yourself a new life. You must, Andrew.
Look, I mean, I get the point that, you know, you can do away with a lot of problems of freedom by getting rid of freedom. Obviously, I'm not advocating for that.
As you wrote in your piece, you're not for censoring people that you disagree with. You don't want government censorship of unpopular political views. I guess that raises the question, what are you advocating for?
I didn't even come close to advocating any government restrictions or regulations in the piece because I'm very, very skeptical of any government restriction on speech of any kind. But I was trying to challenge the notion that because free speech is important, that's the end of the conversation.
You were ratioed, which means, in the parlance of our times, significantly more replies to your tweet than you had retweets or likes. And they were overwhelmingly negative. So we know it didn't strike a positive chord.
Not with the free speech absolutists on Twitter. I wasn't surprised by that. I mean, it's challenging a view that is very, very prevalent on the internet specifically. It's not a random sample. The people who have anime avatars on Twitter are way more likely to be hardcore free speech absolutists than most people.
What's the problem with free speech absolutism?
The problem is just because we love freedom of speech doesn't mean we can pretend that it has no consequences. So absolutism is a lack of complexity that makes us unable to see the world for what it is. I mean, whenever speech is restricted in any way, the first thing you hear from a free speech absolutist is a slippery slope argument. If you restrain Nazis from speaking in Charlottesville, how do we defend against a slippery slope into more and more and more government restrictions? I'm fine with that slippery slope argument. I just don't know why. If you're worried about the slippery slope that comes from restricting Nazis' speech, why aren't you worried about the slippery slope that comes from letting Nazis speak?
Is it fair to say that you don't have a rock-solid faith in the strength of our institutions to uphold democracy?
That is extremely fair to say. I don't have a rock-solid faith in many things, but that is something I have very little faith in.
Why not?
I just think we've seen that institutions are human creations. Humans are extremely fallible. There's no guiding hand drawing us inevitably into some shining future. If you really ask people, are we guaranteed to enter into some shining utopian future? If they really thought about it, they'd say no. But we often act as if the answer is yes. In the old days, it used to be because there was the divine hand of providence, or there was some telos that we were bound to arrive at.
Telos.
A fulfillment, some place we are bound to end up. The kind of American myth is that our telos is greatness. Mm-hmm. Manifest destiny, shining city on a hill. You know, we might hit bumps in the road, but ultimately we are making our union ever more perfect. This is a big part of why people just didn't think it was possible that Trump could be president, because the myth was so strong that it wasn't possible.
The arc may be long, but we incline toward
justice. Maybe. Sometimes we do. But there's no guarantee. So one of my favorite philosophers is this guy named Richard Rorty, who relies on a concept called contingency. Contingency just means there's no predetermined arc. The arc is made by people. In 1989, he has a book called Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity. So there was this notion that we used to be mired in superstition and that we used to be mired in oppressive politics and that the Enlightenment solved both of those things, that there was this movement toward rationality being the center of our philosophical universe and democracy being the center of our political universe. And Rorty is critical of that for many reasons.
Some of which are manifestly obvious.
Some of which are obvious. Politically, you can't think that the Enlightenment was the end of the struggle for freedom when people were literally owning other people. It just doesn't make sense. And Rorty thinks that you can't think of the Enlightenment as the end of philosophical trajectory either, because basically he thinks we were replacing one kind of superstition with another. Instead of having the superstition that some divine hand would carry us into our inevitable future, we replaced that with man or rationality or the universe. And I use man advisedly because there weren't a lot of women around at that time doing this work, which is itself a problem. So Rorty says, no, instead of getting stuck in this predestined arc thing, the idea that will bring us out of that is contingency.
You brought us a piece of tape from a philosopher named Eduardo Mendieta?
Yeah. So unfortunately, Rorty is not with us anymore. He died in 2007. But I spoke to a guy named Eduardo Mendieta, who's a philosopher at Penn State, who spoke to Rorty many, many times through his life, has a book of interviews with Rorty. And we talked about contingency. A lot of people would just sort of tacitly assume, you know, we're on a path toward progress, we are making our union ever more perfect, and that on some level they're just kind of waiting for that to inevitably happen.
That's correct. What Rorty was saying, we have to not use that as banisters or alibis for our commitment toward the institutions that we have created. They're fragile. They were inventions that resulted from a lot of creative and struggle. They're fragile. And that means they can be abolished, they can collapse, and ultimately they can be defeated. We have to not only protect the institutions that we have created, but make them durable and wherever we need to transform them to make them more inclusive.
I wonder if that's what really gets people angry.
Yeah, maybe. I think that people want to have that faith in the American myth. I think people want to see whatever path we're on as a path toward progress.
Once you start picking apart the idea that seems to define America, that our system is unique and uniquely resilient.
And exceptional.
Exactly.
And that we, the American people, are pure and good. Our institutions are made of us. So if you suggest that they could be tending in a terrible direction, then maybe we're terrible.
So your idea is we need to deal with this issue of speech because our system can't take it?
I don't think our institutions are inherently unable to break or inherently always breaking. I don't think the inherent stuff gets us anywhere. I just think things could happen in the future that are surprising. And That, to me, that idea is called contingency. If we think of ourselves as contingent and our national character as contingent and our future as contingent, then we just actually have to look at trends and do the work of getting to where we want to go instead of waiting for it to happen automatically. Freedom means work. It's a struggle, and sometimes it means looking in unpleasant directions. It's very easy to fall into some kind of narrative. Marx has a narrative of history. Hegel has a narrative of history. Even people who are arguing against a previous narrative often, at least according to Rorty, fall into their own narrative without sometimes realizing it.
Ayn Rand.
Exactly. Ayn Rand is a perfect example. It's very easy to see all of human events as reducible to, well, this is what human beings are, and this is how history works, and we're just kind of spectators waiting for it to play itself out.
Mm-hmm.
And any version of that narrative is something that Rorty would have a problem with. The model is wrong. The correct model is a contingent model. The way free speech plays into that is that if you just take care of making sure that the government doesn't get in people's way and that it lets them say whatever they want, you can't just sit back and automatically wait for the arc of history to carry you to where you want to go.
You can't adhere to the notion that it can't happen here.
Right. Talk about myths of American identity. One of the core parts of that is that phrase, it can't happen here, the it referring to fascism, totalitarianism. The 20th century was a pretty scary time throughout the world, and yet the American exceptionalist myth was so strong, people persisted in believing that the scary things that happen in other countries can't happen here.
So tell me about, I don't know, maybe you'd call it a prophetic vision that Rorty shared back in the late 90s. He predicted that both white-collar and blue-collar workers would eventually feel an existential threat and rather than unite, would sort of turn on each other.
So he was a pretty analytical philosopher, but in the 90s, he took a turn toward the public intellectual. He gives this series of lectures at Harvard. He calls it Achieving Our Country, which is after a James Baldwin line. And he has this vision of what might happen. And it's funny because he calls himself a utopian in many ways, but this is a dystopian vision. And again, there's contingency for you, right? Sometimes you envision what the future will be like if everything works out according to your hopes and dreams, and sometimes you envision the opposite. And it's important to hold both in your head. So this one was the vision of what happens if things don't go the way Rorty wants. And in his view, Bill Clinton and what we would now call the neoliberal left was ignoring workers' needs and was not paying attention to the things that give rise to populism, and only the right was paying attention to those needs. He said, at that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen, and postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black and brown Americans and by homosexuals will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. 1997.
Wow. Did he predict when that something would crack?
Not in this speech, but there's another thing he wrote for the New York Times, looking back from this speculative, fictional vantage point of the late 21st century. And in that piece, he said that the year that things started to crack, the beginning of the Dark Ages, was 2014.
Not 2016. I guess there's a couple years off.
Well, maybe, but I actually would argue that the rise of the alt-right and the deep fractional polarization of American politics, I might put that at 2014, the sort of toxic blend that eventually gives rise to Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, Steve Bannon starts recruiting lonely video game teenagers in 2014, right? Not 2016.
Okay, let's just stipulate that our institutions are in fact vulnerable. Now it's time to bring it back to the First Amendment or speech, the defining element of what it is we want to protect, right?
Absolutely.
The marketplace of ideas and so forth?
The marketplace, I don't even believe that the actual marketplace solves everything.
There is no free market, so we'll never know.
Exactly. Well, and I don't think there's a free marketplace of ideas either.
Mm-hmm.
There's corporate speech. There are censors and police of all kinds, whether we see them or not. There's all kinds of speech that the government restricts. Libel, child pornography, harassment of certain kinds, threats of certain kinds. And we don't call that, you know, North Korea. We've just learned to live with it.
There's so much we've learned to live with that we can't see. It's just, what do you choose to restrict?
Just before a change in how we think about or regulate speech, right up until the moment that happens, we take for granted that it can't possibly change. No new restrictions could possibly come into effect. That would be tyranny. That would be North Korea. And then right after it changes, we kind of get used to it.
Well, what about then the view of John Stuart Mill?
John Stuart Mill wrote this amazingly perceptive book called On Liberty, where he really just laid out the case for free speech. I mean, it's kind of all in that book. He lays out a multi-pronged argument for why we should listen to our ideological opponents. Even if they're wrong, they will make our ideas sharper. When they're right, they will make our ideas better. It's actually amazing for a book written in 1859 to be so similar to the way we still talk about free speech today. It's almost uncanny. In fact, people find this stuff so useful and so contemporary that there's a video of the actor Harry Shearer just essentially explaining Mill as a guide to our free speech debates today.
In his book, On Liberty, John Stuart Mill argues for one simple principle, the harm principle. It amounts to this: the state, my neighbors, and everyone else should let me get on with my life as long as I don't harm anyone in the process. One way of thinking of this is, my freedom to swing my fist ends at the tip of your nose. Mill favors free speech, too, up to the point where it inflames violence. But merely causing offense, he thinks, is no grounds for intervention, because in his view, that is not a harm.
He believed that free speech was the fundamental right, the right that gives rise to all the other rights, the bottom of the pyramid.
Yeah, that is for him the pillar.
And for you?
I don't think it's the only one. Speech matters enormously, but so does harm. And I think Mill was wrong to think that speech can't cause harm to the extent that he did believe that. I mean, if we interpret Mill as thinking that speech is always just about me and my beliefs and it can't harm you, I think that's wrong. I think speech can cause individual harm and it can cause societal harm. And so, of course, we need to take speech rights into account, but we need to take other things into account, too.
Coming up, more with Andrew Marantz, wherein he answers the question, is the whole philosophy undergirding our First Amendment fatally flawed?
I don't know about fatally, but it's definitely flawed.
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.